Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 435, recorded on Sunday, July 17th, 2022. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
So this one's going to be a little bit of a shorter episode, and then we're going to have some other episodes of varying lengths, including probably releasing some of the remaining bonus episodes that were never unlocked from Patreon. I'm going to be heading out on various vacations soon, so it'll be a little bit of a different content lineup, but we still got some good stuff coming up for you in the remainder of July and through August. This week, we're talking about Telstar. As we briefly mentioned last week in our episode on Western Union, Telstar was a series of communication satellites jointly owned by AT&T, Bell Telephone Laboratories, NASA, GPO, which is the UK's state communications firm, and the Nationale PTT, which was France's state communications firm. Telstar 1 and 2, the first generation Telstar satellites, had a great deal of significance at the time, not just culturally, but politically and economically, even if they were short-lived. It's the space race equivalent of the short-lived first transatlantic telegraph cable in 1858, which sputtered out after only 3 weeks. I'd say it's kind of a proof of concept over a few brief months for changing the time-space relationship of certain economic communications, not because there wasn't already reliable live communications across the Atlantic of other kinds, but because this allowed for live television broadcasts across the ocean, including, perhaps most significantly for the period, live broadcasts of the American presidency to other parts of the world. And I do think that's really important to understand contextually here. Is obviously this is before the moon landing and so forth, but this is well into the nuclear age at this point. And the U.S. is clearly the economic and military hegemon, or at least the paired opposite to the Soviet Union at the time. In order for that to sort of reach its full maximum potential in the 1960s, you also need to be able to broadcast those words live simultaneously from Washington, D.C., or wherever the president may be, to especially Western Europe, but also other parts of the world. So again, this isn't something that lasts for a huge amount of time, but it shows what might potentially happen. And Rachel's going to tell us a little bit more about the technology, how it got put into space, and some of the initial experimental uses that sort of showed what satellite technologies could do, especially in the realm of video communications, as opposed to transatlantic telegraph and telephone cables that already existed. So Rachel, can you walk us through what Telstar was and also what it wasn't? Because it's obviously part of an iterative process, as many of these technologies that we discuss are.
Right. So a lot of the sourcing for this episode came from the Wikipedia articles on Telstar, Telstar 1, and Telstar 2, as well as the Air and Space Museum website and an industry website, Intelsat. So first of all, Telstar wasn't the first communication satellite. That distinction belongs to the U.S. Army satellite SCORE, which stood for Signal Communications by Orbiting Relay Equipment, which launched December 18, 1958. It transmitted a short Christmas message from President Eisenhower via shortwave radio through an onboard tape recorder, which was the first transmission of a human voice from space. So Telstar 1 launched just a few short years later, July 10th, 1962. It had the capability to transmit live television signals between the United States and Europe. The first image, a still image, the flag flying at Andover Earth Station in Andover, Maine, was transmitted to Plumier Baudou, which was the French station, just one day after launch, so July 11th, 1962. This footage was private, not transmitted to the general public. It was just kind of proof that it worked and was successful. So it's important to note that data transmissions were restricted to 30 minutes at a time because Telstar 1's medium Earth orbit limited simultaneous visibility of the ground stations on either side of the Atlantic Ocean. So it wasn't able to transmit images across the Atlantic Ocean unless it had visibility to both of those ground stations. So it had a period of about 2.5 hours. So every 2.5 hours, it could transmit for 30 minutes. So quoting from the Wikipedia article on Telstar, almost 2 weeks later, on July 23rd at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, it relayed the first publicly available live transatlantic television signal. The broadcast was shown in Europe by Eurovision and in North America by NBC, CBS, ABC, and the CBC. The first public broadcast featured CBS's Walter Cronkite and NBC's Chet Huntley in New York and the BBC's Richard Dimbleby in Brussels. The first pictures were the Statue of Liberty in New York and the Eiffel Tower in Paris. The first broadcast was to have been remarks by President John F. Kennedy, but the signal was acquired before the president was ready, so engineers filled the lead-in time with a short segment of a televised game between the Philadelphia Phillies and the Chicago Cubs at Wrigley Field. The batter, Tony Taylor, was seen hitting a ball pitched by Cal Kuntz to the right fielder, George Altman. From there, the video switched first to Washington, D.C., then to Cape Canaveral, Florida, to the Seattle World's Fair, then to Quebec, and finally to Stratford, Ontario. The Washington segment included remarks by President Kennedy talking about the price of the American dollar, which was causing concern in Europe.
I understand that part of today's press conference is being relayed by the Telstar communications satellite to viewers across the Atlantic, and this is another indication of the extraordinary world in which we live. This satellite must be high enough to carry messages from both sides of the world, which is, of course, a very essential requirement for peace. And I think this understanding, which will inevitably come from these speedier communications, is bound to increase the well-being and security of all people here and those across the oceans. So we're glad to participate in this operation developed by private industry, launched by government in admirable cooperation. If the United States refused to cash in dollars for gold, then everyone would go to the gold standard. The United States, which is the reserve currency of the whole free world, we would all be dependent upon the available supply of gold, which is quite limited. Obviously isn't enough to finance the great movements of trade today, and it would be the most backward step that the United States has taken since the end of the Second World War. We have substantially improved our position this quarter, the second quarter over the first quarter. Our loss is down to almost a third of what it was in the first quarter. Our loss is based on the first and second quarter of this year is about a half of what it was last year and about a third of what it was the year before. We hope that we can bring our balance of payments into balance by the end of next year. We are not going to devalue. There is no possible use in the United States devaluing. Every other currency, in a sense, is tied to the dollar. If we devalued, all other currencies would devalue, and so that those who speculate against the dollar are going to lose. The United States will not devalue its dollar. And the fact of the matter is the United States can balance its balance of payments any day it wants if it wishes to withdraw its support of our defense expenditures overseas and our foreign aid. Now, these have been undertaken. We have put over $50 billion into Europe alone since 1945. And we are not requesting them to do anything but to meet their responsibilities for their own defense, as we are helping to meet them. We spend $1.5 billion in the defense of Europe and the NATO commitments. 30% of the infrastructure of NATO is paid for by the United States. We don't object to that. We are not going to devalue. We are going to be able, we think, to bring our balance of payments into balance by the end of next year. And I feel that those who hold dollars abroad have a very good investment. And we have over $16.5 billion here in the United States. We have over $50 billion held by American citizens in investments overseas. This country is a very solvent country, so that I feel that it requires a cooperative effort by all those involved in order to maintain this free currency, the dollar, upon which so much of Western prosperity is built. And I have confidence in it, and I think that if others examine the wealth of this country and its determination to bring its balance of payments into order, which it will do, I think that they will feel that the dollar is a good investment and as good as gold.
When Kennedy denied that the United States would devalue the dollar, it immediately strengthened on world markets. Cronkite later said that, quote, "We all glimpsed something of the true power of the instrument we had wrought," end quote. That evening, Telstar 1 also relayed the first satellite telephone call between U.S. Vice President Lyndon Johnson and the chairman of AT&T, Frederick Cabell. It successfully transmitted faxes, data, and both live and taped television, including the first live transmission of television across an ocean from Andover, Maine, U.S., to Goonhilly Downs, England, and Plumier-Baudou, France. As an aside, an experimental passive satellite, Echo 1, had been used to reflect and redirect communication signals 2 years earlier, in 1960. In August 1962, Telstar 1 became the first satellite used to synchronize time between two continents, bringing the United Kingdom and the United States to within 1 microsecond of each other. Previous efforts were accurate to only 2,000 microseconds. The Telstar 1 satellite also relayed computer data between two IBM 1401 computers. The test, performed on October 25, 1962, sent a message from a transmitting computer in Endicott, New York, to the Earth station in Andover, Maine. The message was relayed to the Earth station in France, where it was decoded by a second IBM 1401 in La Gaude, France. Telstar 1, which had ushered in a new age of the commercial use of technology, became a victim of the military technology of the Cold War era. The day before Telstar 1 launched, a U.S. high-altitude nuclear bomb, called Starfish Prime, had energized the Earth's Van Allen belt, where Telstar 1 went into orbit. This vast increase in a radiation belt, combined with subsequent high-altitude blasts, including a Soviet test in October, overwhelmed Telstar's fragile transistors. It went out of service in November 1962 after handling over 400 telephone, telegraph, facsimile, and television transmissions. It was restarted by a workaround in early January 1963. The additional radiation associated with its return to full sunlight once again caused a transistor failure, this time irreparably, and Telstar 1 went back out of service on February 21st, 1963. So a very short-lived lifespan, July 1962 to February 1963. But, as Bill mentioned, it was a proof of concept. It did show that it worked and was able to transmit television signals as well as telephone, telegraph, other communication signals. So later, Telstar 2 was launched. Telstar 2 was virtually identical to Telstar 1. The main difference was that Telstar 2 also carried scientific equipment to measure the proton and electron distribution of Earth's Van Allen belts. These data were transmitted via its microwave telemetry system. This system stayed active after Telstar 2's VHF transmitter was turned off after 2 years of service in 1965. Much like Telstar 1, Telstar 2's transmissions were limited to the 30 minutes of its, well, it had a slightly longer period of 3 hours 45 minutes, and it was still limited to that 30 minutes in its period when both the receiving and transmitting ground stations were visible. So, as I said, it had a more limited service date. It was a planned end of service of 2 years, and it also was able to transmit television signals, telephone signals, and so forth. Experiments continued, and by 1964, two Telstars, two relay units. The relay units were from RCA, and we did talk about RCA on episode 356 for March 2021, and two SynCom units, and those SynCom units were from the Hughes Aircraft Company, and they operated successfully in space as well. SynCom 2 was the first geosynchronous satellite, and its successor, SynCom 3, broadcast pictures from the 1964 Summer Olympics in Tokyo. The first commercial geosynchronous satellite was Intelsat 1, also known as Early Bird, launched in 1965. Subsequent waves of Telstar satellites were launched starting 2 decades later in 1983. They were far more advanced commercial geosynchronous satellites and shared little in common with the first generation of Telstar other than the name. The most recent Telstar satellite, Telstar 19V, was launched July 22, 2018 on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. I found an Air and Space Museum blog that includes pictures of the satellite. it's just it's a pretty small looking ball that is covered with like solar cells and these transmission antenna. It's very interesting to look back at that 1960 like space race technology and how it was able to do these advanced transmissions while looking very Jetsons like, kind of retro futuristic. They also wrote a little history of Telstar, and I found a paragraph that was very interesting. Telstar was one of the most significant communication satellites of the early space age. It raised an important policy question: should communication satellites be operated and controlled by private corporations or under government auspices? The United States chose government direction and created two new institutions, COMSAT and IntelSat, to develop satellite communications, an arrangement that lasted for more than two decades. And so that sent me on a search for COMSAT, and I found out that today COMSAT and IntelSat is a private company headquartered in Herndon, Virginia, owned by Satcom Direct. And they have a little history timeline. And the privatization occurred in 2001 after operating for 37 years as an intergovernmental organization. So I found that very interesting that it got privatized in 2001 after operating quite successfully as that governmental agency. So Bill, we kind of raised a couple of interesting points. The power of communications, of that instantaneous communication, and also the government control and development of satellite technology and its future privatization.
Yeah, so one of the things that I remember we talked about on our episode about the transatlantic telegraph cable was that it had a pretty immediate impact on things like cotton prices between New York and London or wherever in England, and people could bid more competitively based on more up-to-date access to information, whether it was that short-lived one during the Buchanan administration or the post-Civil War period when they finally got one going that actually was durable enough. And I think it's interesting that we see with Telstar, literally the first broadcast made to the public using simulcast video of a speech. It was a live speech from President Kennedy talking about the U.S. dollar and what the U.S. government's policy on the dollar was going to be, and that this had an immediate effect in European markets. I just thought that was such a fascinating parallel, you know, 100 years apart. And it also, I think, really reflects the different position that the United States was in. Obviously, the United States was very important for cotton in 1858 and to a lesser extent in the late 1860s, although still quite important. And then by the 1960s, it is the world economic power. You can refer to the episode I did on Nixon's gold in the series on the 1970s, where I talk more about the Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon eras in terms of dollar policy on the world stage and so forth, and dollar reserve currency status. And, you know, you then also see that this sort of military the atomic presidency, the nuclear executive, gives this speech, and then a few months later, this satellite basically bites the dust because of U.S. nuclear weapons testing in the atmosphere.
Yeah, I found that kind of poetic as well. yeah, the military kind of destroying the communications technology, kind of showing these like dual developmental tracks. And we've kind of gone whole hog on military versus these nice communications developments. So I found that pretty poetic. And also, I just wanted to highlight what Walter Cronkite said: "We all glimpsed something of the true power of the instrument we had wrought." And I'm not sure if he was trying to echo Samuel Morse's first telegraph that he sent, "What hath God wrought?"
He had to be, right?
He had to be, yeah. I thought that was pretty interesting that he chose to kind of make this connection between the first telegraph and the first simultaneous television broadcast. So I thought that was pretty interesting, and it kind of validates that we're kind of on the right track talking about these various technologies and how they impacted communications and the economic ramifications of those communications as well. The other thing I wanted to highlight was the fact that we created ComSat and IntelSat to control these satellite tech programs, and then it operated as a government agency for 37 years, and then later we decided to privatize it. Did you have any thoughts on that as well?
Yeah, definitely. So obviously, you know, the privatization in 2001, right, that's full swing neoliberalism, just privatize everything, and especially the 90s in particular had been an era of privatizing lots of things around telecoms and internet and everything. And I think this goes completely hand in hand with that. And so obviously to that aspect, no surprise there. But also, you know, like you mentioned, the later program named Telstar, which doesn't really have that much to do with the original Telstar, but is at least worth mentioning in passing. That's something that starts in the 1980s. It's still under that at the time at that, you know, government program that you're just talking about. And then now, not only is the program overseeing the satellites privatized, but the actual rockets carrying them into space are privatized. SpaceX, obviously, you know, I mean, they receive massive government subsidies, but ultimately, instead of it just being a privately built rocket that's supplied to the government, now it's a private company doing the launches and so forth. So you get even more and more of the pieces being privatized, which obviously the perspective of our show is that that's bad and not to be celebrated for a variety of reasons. But that is kind of an interesting through line through that whole narrative story on this. And to go back to something that we mentioned at the beginning, and this is actually why we brought up Telstar in passing at all on our Western Union episode, was we emphasized that the Western Union satellite was the first fully private commercial satellite, obviously still launched, I think, through the government aegis, but it wasn't co-owned by the government in the sense that the NASA ownership reflected with Telstar, and that's what we were contrasting it with. And, you know, the sort of uniquely American approach of the 1960s is reflected in Telstar 1 especially, because as we mentioned at the beginning of this episode and last week on the Western Union episode, this was a project of AT&T and Bell Telephone Laboratories, both private companies with massive government ties and contracts in the United States, and also NASA directly being a government agency. And then on the other side of the Atlantic, there are partner organizations, not just obviously the broadcaster partners, which you see the similar dynamic of private broadcaster in the U.S. versus state broadcaster, like the BBC in Britain, but that the co-owners with AT&T, Bell Labs, and NASA from the British side is GPO, which had been this was the postal company that was at the time, communications conglomerate owned by the government and hadn't been privatized yet, and Nationale PTT, which was France's state communications firm at the time. And seeing the different approaches that was being taken, I think, is reflected in this project and the ownership structure of it. And I thought that was interesting as well. I don't know if you thought anything about that or if that caught your eye.
Yeah, that definitely jumped out at me. And then the other like experimental satellites that were getting launched as well, like the relay units from RCA and the SINCOM units from the Hughes Aircraft Company, were also these private companies working with NASA to launch their own satellites. I thought that was fairly interesting. And yeah, that definitely jumped out at me. It does make it seem that the privatization, the public-private partnerships did work in our favor, because, I mean, they were American satellites. They weren't British satellites or French satellites. So I think just having all that capital flowing did lead us to these innovations. But it is interesting that we had the private TV companies or the private like radio companies and telephone companies versus these like state run telecoms organizations. So I thought that was a pretty interesting detail that definitely jumped out at me.
And I want to emphasize as well, another parallel, going back to that transatlantic telegraph cable episode, we talked about a whole bunch of the different projects that were attempted, you know, some that were total failures, some that were partial successes, some that were complete successes. And we talked about the New York, Newfoundland, and London Telegraph Company. We talked about the Atlantic Telegraph Company. We talked about the that later became the Anglo-American Telegraph Company. Generally, the Anglo-American Telegraph Company, for example, ended up being either invested in or merged with several undersea cable laying companies in the U.S., U.K., and France. So that's just another very obvious parallel here, where these three countries were, despite, you know, sometimes having some friction and problems with each other, they were so economically interrelated that whether it was private capital or state capital, depending on the era, they were all hand in hand working on this project together. And that, I think, is an interesting echo through history as well. And I think, you know, listeners can probably see that we are starting to move toward doing more Third Industrial Revolution topics. It's not going to be a consistent thing because we're still going to jump around as we see thematically appropriate or as we feel like it. But that this is now well into the era. And you also mentioned that a integral part of this isn't just the rocket technology, which we did an episode about that. It's not just the physical transistors, which we're going to do some episodes about that. It's not the satellite as a whole. Part of it that makes this work, this broadcast work in 1962, is having these huge IBM computers running the decoding and encoding for all the communications for these satellites. And that's something we also talked about, whether it was container ships and their terminals and using IBMs to, you know, sort out how to load the ship properly. We talked about IBM and Telex with regard to the Chilean CyberSyn program. We talked, obviously, about Telex and some other things in relation to Western Union. So you can start to see these strands coming together. And these are some of the things that really differentiate this era from the Second Industrial Revolution, except that the point that is also crucial to make, and I think this Telstar episode really makes that very well, is that it's also a continuous process, that the First Industrial Revolution is not separate from the Second Industrial Revolution, which is not separate from the Third Industrial Revolution. These are phases. You can identify distinct parts in them. You can identify key tipping points and turning points in them, but ultimately, there's transitional technologies as well, and there's things that are analogs and echoes of things that we've already seen and talked about on other episodes.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that France, UK, US echo from the telegraphic era to this transistor era. That was an interesting repeat from the Second Industrial Revolution in going into the Third Industrial Revolution. I think we'll see a lot more of these kind of echoes and repeats as we start kind of transitioning and start tying together the Second and Third Industrial Revolutions.
All right. Well, Rachel, thanks so much for coming on the show this week.
Thanks. It was an interesting topic this week.